This is why I ran for governor. This is why we don't have a gas line today, because we refuse to stand up for ourselves.
Governor Walker calls new gas line legislation from House Republicans un-Alaskan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's annual hide and horn auction.
I'm down here to buy bear hides, horns and antlers, and anything else I can get.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Since Governor Bill Walker was inaugurated, he and the legislature's Republican leadership have traded reams of angry letters and testy press releases. Now their paper battle has transformed into outright hostility in dueling press conferences. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez is on the line to talk about the disagreements over a proposed natural gas line. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
So, Alexandra, what triggered this dispute?
Well, shortly after 11 a.m., the members of the House's Republican leadership dropped a bill that would put constraints on the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, which a lot of people think of as the little gas line. The project had been conceived as a backup plan to the AK LNG project. That's the $50-plus billion project that would be the natural gas equivalent of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And that project involves the state partnering as a minority player with Exxon, BP, ConocoPhillips, and TransCanada to get it built. But in February, the governor announced he was going to turn the little line into a big line, too. With that vision, ASAP would be a massive export project, like AKLNG, but with the state positioned to take a majority share, something that's been a priority for the governor, but has been met with some skepticism from the legislature because of the risk and the cost of taking that position. The bill that was released today would stop that plan dead. It puts limits on how much natural gas the ASAP project could transfer for export, and it effectively puts a cap on how big the project could be. The legislators behind it say the motive is to show Alaska is not pursuing two competing projects at the same time, which they think might make the partners in the AKLNG project skittish.
How did the governor react to this?
Well, less than 2 hours after the bill was introduced, the governor called a press conference in reaction. Let's just say that Governor Walker was not amused.
This is why I ran for governor. This is why we don't have a gas line today, because we refuse to stand up for ourselves.
Walker held up a marked version of his bill with scrawled underlines and exclamation points, and he called it an outrage. He also questioned the motives of the five bill sponsors, House Speaker Mike Chenault, Rules Chair Craig Johnson, Majority Leader Sharice Millett, Majority Whip Bob Herron, and Representative Mike Hawker.
I'm shocked that it got this many sponsors. I really question who these people work for. They're certainly not reading the same constitution I'm reading.
Walker said the bill would take away the state's negotiating power if it made it so the state could only pursue one option, and he proceeded to call the bill un-Alaskan.
What do the bill sponsors think of his reaction?
They certainly got a rise out of him. The sponsors definitely were offended by the statement that they aren't working for Alaskans. Each repeatedly said that, you know, I represent the people from my district, and I also represent the other people in this state. I think that they mostly were trying to take it in stride, though. The press conference they held felt radically different from the one the governor held. Instead of having it be a kind of stand-up affair, the five sponsors gathered in the speaker's office. They were all sort of relaxed on the couch and trying to, I think, play things as cool as they could. But they did say that the bill would go through the process and that they were surprised that they got such an angry reaction from it.
So, Alexandra, what happens to the bill now?
in a way, this is kind of like the legislature poking the bear. While some of the sponsors said they were surprised that Walker reacted the way he did, it's really not that shocking that he would oppose a bill that's meant to torpedo his new gas line plan. But in the end, as governor, he's still the bear, and he said the bill was dead on arrival.
I would veto this in a minute.
So even though the bill will be heard and go through the process, the substance of the legislation almost doesn't matter at all. It's just another way where these two competing powers can promote their two competing visions for a gas line.
All right. Well, thank you, Alexandra, for keeping us updated on this ongoing legislative dust-up.
My pleasure, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez. A coalition of environmental groups plan to sue to stop Royal Dutch Shell from using Seattle's waterfront as a home port for its Arctic oil drilling fleet. The Port of Seattle earlier this month signed a two-year lease for 50 acres across from downtown Seattle to Foss Maritime, whose client is Shell. The groups allege that the port violated state environmental laws when it did not do a review. The groups include the Sierra Club and Seattle Audubon Society. They held a press conference today. The port CEO has said that the lease complies with environmental regulations and will bring in about $13 million in rent over the 2 years. Eight vessels would be moored at the terminal. Members of the Legislative Bush Caucus were told last week in a lunch-and-learn session on rural sanitation that the state needs almost $1 billion to build, replace, and maintain rural sanitation systems. But as Cambier's Jacqueline Estes reports, the gap between the level of need and funding is large.
State and tribal representatives told members of the Bush Caucus it would take about $900 million to do what's needed to bring modern sanitation to all Alaskans. Last year, the state put about $9 million and federal agencies put $51 million toward rural sanitation in Alaska. The combined $60 million is less than half of allocations 10 years ago. David Beveridge, the director of project management at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, or ANTHC, says Alaska is competing with other states for its share of a shrinking pool of federal funding.
If you look through the Build Safe Water program, it gets matched with federal dollars on a 75% ratio. So for every $25, the federal government will kick in the $75. So that's been a big component of the funding in Alaska, and that's gone down.
The issue is one of public health. According to Bill Griffith, the facility program manager for Village Safe Water with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, he told legislators recent studies show Alaskans without clean water and flush toilets experience dramatically higher rates of hospitalization for respiratory diseases such as pneumonia.
Those rates were anywhere from 5 times greater to 11 times greater in villages in Alaska with less than 10% of homes served.
And Griffith says a significant number of Alaskan communities are unserved or underserved.
There's about 30 villages around the state that still don't have running water and sewer to any homes, coupled with about a dozen or so communities that have what we call small haul systems, where they use trailers and to bring water to homes, and then they use different trailers to pick up sewage.
Climate change is adding to the magnitude of the issue. Gavin Dixon manages a rural energy initiative for ANTHC.
We're having homes where we have connections to homes with Arctic pipes. Homes will settle and the pipes don't, so there's differential settling, and that stuff will break away from the houses. There's a lot of conditions that are happening. We have the flooding. We don't have the sea ice to protect the shores. A lot of cases, you look at what happened in Kotlik, and it wiped almost the whole system out just in a matter of hours.
Dixon says energy audits show that investments of an average of $80,000 per community for little fixes would return much more in energy cost savings in just 4 or 5 years. He says those savings in energy costs would boost local economies and cut state spending for power cost equalization subsidies. Representative Neil Foster of Nome says improving rural sanitation would boost the state's economy, and he says legislators would create an uproar if they experienced the same conditions.
Boy, if we ever took every toilet out of this building, it would be a revolution. We wouldn't stand for people essentially living in a third world type situation. And so I think it's something that that needs to be made a priority. I think that we have to bring the people, you know, at the lowest rungs up before we can kind of move forward as a state.
Agencies and tribes are collaborating to improve operator training and to reduce operational costs, and they're working with the private sector to create innovative designs well-suited to Arctic conditions. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dozens of racers take on Alaska's vast wilderness under their own power.
They're very much on their own, and they do enjoy that solitude. They don't want an aid station every 10 miles and people everywhere.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game held its annual hide and horn auction in downtown Anchorage yesterday, selling off all the leftover animal products the state comes to possess while managing Alaska's wildlife. This year, an enormous number of caribou antlers went to bid, the result of a trafficking case stretching from Juneau to the northwest Arctic village of Selawik. KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports on how the auction is not just a fur rendezvous tradition, but part of how the state manages its wildlife resources.
Crowds of people stroll between dozens of bear hides, sheep capes, and bundles of caribou antlers duct taped together, looking like thigh-high tumbleweeds. On stage, helpers hold branch-like antlers high overhead while the auctioneer prods patrons towards $200 or so for a set. Russell Knight is bidding on supplies for his business.
I'm owner of Knight's Taxidermy here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm down here to buy bear hides, horns and antlers, and anything else I can get.
This is the state's largest auction of wildlife products, part of Anchorage's annual Fur Rendezvous celebration.
And can you just explain to me one more time about what a fur rendezvous is and where it dates back to?
Well, traditionally, a rendezvous would be where the trappers and hunters would come, get together, drink a lot of whiskey, and sell their pelts.
Richard Person is with the Alaska Trappers Association, which has won the contract to put on the auction for the state the last few years. Many of the people who bid the most aggressively are professional buyers loading up on supplies for taxidermy, handicrafts, and fine arts at relatively low prices. But Person believes it's one of the few ways the state is able to share some of its rarest resources with residents.
It gives a chance for regular folks who don't have an opportunity to maybe take one of these animals in a hunting situation to come and still participate and own a piece of Alaskan resource that is unique.
This year's auction is especially unique. The state has a ton and a half of caribou antlers for sale. Most are from just one criminal case. Wildlife trooper Brian Miller flew to Kotzebue in 2011 to investigate reports of an outside buyer shipping huge quantities of antlers to the road system on a freight plane.
It had been sent from the village of Selawik, and prior to the shipping from the village, it had been wrapped up on pallets, stacks of antlers wrapped in plastic, probably about 4 to 5 feet high.
It's illegal to buy or sell raw antlers in the Northwest Arctic Borough, where caribou are key subsistence stock, and pressure from antler buyers in the 80s and 90s led to a troubling wave of wanton waste cases. In the 2011 case, the state brought 22 misdemeanor charges against Harbor Stanton of Copper Center, whose trip, according to charging documents, was financed by Ivory Jack's trading company in Juneau.
Yeah, well, that was interesting. I've not come across that before or since.
Last July, Stanton settled the case. He was fined $500 and had the antlers confiscated, which begs the question, what is the state to do when it suddenly acquires 2,000 pounds of illegal caribou antlers? Typically, since they don't need to be fleshed or sealed like hides, they head straight to a warehouse until they find a new home. Wildlife technician Jim Holmes is with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. It's his job to wrangle the full force of the state's bureaucracy when it comes to sharing wildlife resources, even the ones obtained in unfortunate circumstances.
Typically, throughout the year, I get requests from schools, museums, educational facilities, visitor centers, places like that, who are requesting these items for educational purposes.
Holmes estimates the annual auction is just 1% of his total workload. Most of the time, he arranges for roadkill, animals taken out of season, or in defense of life and property to be taxidermied or tanned, then redistributed to public areas where residents can view them. The auction usually brings in between $40,000 and $60,000 of revenue, which covers the costs of processing all the horns and hides the department manages in the course of a year. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries, in action over the weekend, banned the use of unmanned aircraft to aid in salmon fishing. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Member Reed Morisky and Chairman Tom Klubertson framed the board's anti-drone position.
I'm for keeping pilots employed and not using unmanned aircraft for fish spotting. So.
Thank you. And I tend to look very hard at existing patterns of areas and fisheries, and I really do like, whenever possible, to promote economic stability. So we've had aircraft in this vicinity for a long time, this region, and you know, there are folks who stake their livelihood and they contribute to all the local economies flying their aircraft, and I feel like it's just an unnecessary move, and as Member Jeffrey said, it's not something I want over my head.
Strictly speaking, the Board of Fish lacks jurisdiction over aircraft use, but it can and did ban the use of drones to aid in all commercial salmon fishing. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The state is expecting a bigger run of king salmon over on the Kuskokwim this summer, but still well below average. State managers say they expect strong conservation measures to continue in 2015 to ensure enough fish make it up the river to spawn. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, they're seeking early input to make the season a success.
On the bright side, state managers are confident that the Kuskokwim drainage made the escapement goal in 2014, a year with a weak run and unprecedented early season fishing restrictions. They announced their 2015 forecast of 96,000 to 163,000 king salmon, up from the 70,000 to 117,000 they predicted last year. Aaron Potter is the Kuskokwim Area Salmon Management Biologist.
It's going to be a well below average run based on that. And so we'll certainly need to be, again, conservative in the 2015 season.
The 25-year average for the river is double the forecast size, around 243,000 fish. King salmon have been in decline for several years. The fishery was federalized last summer and saw directed king salmon fishing closed, except for a brief taste through community permits. Heavy salmon restrictions were in place from May and June. Potter says he and his colleagues have not decided on any specific restrictions at this point.
You know, if the forecast does come to fruition, you know, we should have a few more Chinook in the river than we did in the 14 season. Again, it's a forecast, but we won't really know until the season begins. So, you know, if we do start with the early season closure like we did in 14, that will give us an opportunity to, you know, again, be conservative in our approach to the 15 season. It'll begin to give us an idea on how the run is coming together, strength of it.
The Board of Fish will consider proposals in March for gear changes during king salmon conservation periods. One would require that whitefish nets be staked, another could limit the length of nets, and a third changes rules for fish wheels. To prepare for 2015, Potter says the department is hosting 3 days of meetings in Bethel, March 25th through the 27th. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The American Lung Association of Alaska invites you to join their premier annual cycling event, the Clean Air Challenge, on May 9th. This family-friendly one-day event begins in Talkeetna and offers routes ranging from 10 to 100 miles. This fundraiser benefits the American Lung Association to support lung health programs across Alaska. For more information, visit cleanairchallengeak.org.
53 racers are taking on Alaska's vast wilderness under their own power as part of the Iditarod Trail Invitational. The race follows the historic Iditarod Trail from Kinnick to Nome. It's billed as the world's longest ultramarathon by bike, foot, or ski. KSKA's Evan Erickson was at Kinnick Lake for the race's start yesterday afternoon.
Troy Jakoski is in the smoky Kinnick Bar near Wasilla, packing in as many calories as possible.
I've got a big plate of fries, so plenty of fat, plenty of carbs.
Jakoski will need the fuel. He's trying to become the first Australian to complete the 350-mile race to McGrath. He's eager to get rolling on the trail, but knows the importance of understanding what his body can tolerate.
Mentally, you want to try and stick with the fast guys, but in the end, you've really got to ride at your own pace. And it's not a race that's won in the first day. It's a series of days, and there are a lot of challenges out there.
While most of the 53 competitors are headed to McGrath, a group of about a dozen are on the 1,000-mile trek to Nome following the Southern Iditarod route. The race functions as an invitational for good reason. Competitors are vetted by race officials based on their abilities to be self-sufficient in extreme conditions. Many qualify based on other ultra races, and some get their first green light to McGrath by attending 5-day training camps held by the race organizers in the Mat-Su Valley. Katie Merchant is the ITI race director.
We offer very little support, and we want to keep it that way. They're very much on their own, and they do enjoy that solitude, I think, and the experience of the wilderness of Alaska. In the wilderness in Alaska, they don't want an aid station every 10 miles and people everywhere.
While completing either the 350 or 1,000-mile trails can be an end in itself, in recent years, several racers have upped the ante. Ultra runner David Johnston last year smashed the 350-mile foot record, reaching McGrath in just over 4 days. That same year, Fairbanks fat biker Kevin Breitenbach blazed hard-packed trails to McGrath in 2 days, 4 hours, and 43 minutes, clocking times significantly faster than lead Iditarod sled dog teams. For Breitenbach, sleep becomes a luxury.
With trails as fast as they are, you can kind of hammer yourself and then take a bit of time to relax and get some rest. But last year I slept about a total of an hour and probably plan on something around the same this year. I think no matter how often you do this race, you never feel prepared for it. I feel that same way right now, so I think everyone's got, if you don't have nerves, you're probably doing something wrong.
The ITI allows racers traveling to Nome 30 days for an official finish. With bike and foot records of just over 10 and 20 days and far fewer finishers, completing the long-form ITI is an achievement in itself. Frank Janssens came from Vancouver, BC.
I'm just about to start for the Iditarod Trail Invitational on the way to Nome, so the 1,000 miles.
By bicycle?
Bicycle, yes. Yeah. I've done it last year, but I had to scratch after Galena. So I turned back in Galena, and so it's kind of a revenge for me this year, trying to go to Nome. Well, I tried to show that I'm calm, but actually inside I'm not that calm.
This year, more than half the racers are from outside Alaska. Pittsburgh attorney Tim Hewitt holds several foot records and has found the challenges of the ITI irresistible. He's completed the course to Nome 9 times on foot. This year, he's going by bike.
People say, well, you know, are you nuts? Why do you just keep going back? But every time, it really is a different experience. And every time you get to Nome, you think, I'll never do this again. It's ridiculous. And within a month or two, there's a magnetism about, I think, just being out there in the wilderness. It's a wonderful experience. If you can get back here, I think almost everybody would.
No cash prizes await the ITI champions, but something keeps them coming back for more. In Anchorage, I'm Evan Erickson.
Anchorage is celebrating its centennial this year, but the area has been inhabited for centuries longer by the Dena'ina, who still live in the area today. KSKA's Ann Hillman spoke with Dena'ina historian Aaron Leggett about the area's past and its future.
For centuries, the Dena'ina of Aklutna started their fishing season in the spring at what's now the heavily industrialized area of Ship Creek, near modern-day downtown Anchorage.
If times were getting tough in the spring when you're in that kind of transitional period, and maybe your winter supply of salmon didn't last, that you could go to Dagaitnu.
That's the Dena'ina name for the area, says tribal member and historian Aaron Leggett.
And catch the three-spine stickleback. So not a very big fish. You know, they grow to maybe 3 or 4 inches. So they must have been catching them by the tens of thousands, and then they would make a soup and a broth, particularly from that.
But in 1915, a group of settlers built a tent city right where the Dena'ina fished. Leggett says his people adapted. They found work on the railroad and focused their efforts on other traditional fishing sites, like Point Warren's off.
How adventurous do you want to be?
Aaron Leggett walks down the ice-encrusted trail to the beach and looks out over the water.
100 years ago, when Dena'ina was the predominant language spoken here, this is Nu-Chish-Tunt, a place protected from the wind.
Dena'ina came to the area every spring and early summer to fish in the silty waters for king and silver salmon. They fished across Kinnick Arm, too, and off of Fire Island. North of Ship Creek, they set up a type of wooden scaffolding over the mudflats so they could harvest salmon even when the tides went out. But the local Dena'ina were forced to give up another favored fishing spot when the U.S. military took over Point Warren's off during the Cold War. So what remains of the fish camps? Leggett says not much, and what is there he wants left alone.
We do know of some things that were left behind, but we don't like to talk specifically about what they were, just because of concerns of looting and that sort of thing, but nothing really that I could say specifically.
So is the area still important for the Dena'ina people?
I guess to me, you know, the connection is that despite airplanes flying overhead
and the parking lot and the windmills and the lack of trees, the ocean is still the same. Leggett says that many people more often visit other places, like Eklutna Lake, to find spiritual connections. But all of the Anchorage Bowl is part of their homeland. It's where they hunted caribou and gathered berries in the summer. He says it's something that many people, even other Alaska natives, used to forget.
Today, now, you know, if I say I'm Dena'ina, most people, or a lot of people, will say, oh, you guys are the Indians that used to live here. And I say, well, we're still here, but at least you recognize that we used to be here, because I don't know, for some reason, maybe because Anchorage is always looking to the future, it was like it was an empty cultural vacuum.
But Leggett says that's starting to change in Anchorage as the Dena'ina themselves continue to reawaken to their own culture and educate others. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Evan Erickson in Kinnick. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University offers working professionals courses designed to fit their busy lifestyles. With hybrid online and in-person classes, the MBA at APU is an accelerated, affordable, and high-quality pathway to career advancement. Learn more by calling 800-252-7528 or visiting alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.